Well, you know, they all average about 20%.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. We apologize for getting started a few minutes late. Our staff today from Legislative Revenue is the is Elizabeth Martin Maher. We welcome you today, and we will go right into the corporate excise tax. This is riveting, so please drop the temperature in the room. Elizabeth?
Chairman Butler and committee members, just for the record, I'm Elizabeth Martin Maher with Legislative Revenue Office. So this is going to kind of piggyback on the personal income taxes that we discussed last week, or I guess it was almost 2 weeks ago now. And then we'll talk about corporate excise taxes today and also just other business taxes to kind of give you a little broader perspective on business. Basically, Oregon taxes businesses who are doing some kind of business here in Oregon and they have a physical presence in Oregon. The excise tax is paid by corporations who have nexus in Oregon. And nexus is just a term to really kind of describe connection with the state of Oregon. It is really, nexus is determining the degree of business activity that there is here in Oregon. And then that means if there is a sufficient amount of activity here, then the state can tax. And then it would be the excise, corporate excise tax that we'd be imposing. Now, I kind of, before I talk on the personal income tax side with the withholdings, well, now I want to kind of describe some of, to give you kind of the bigger picture of the corporate revenues stream that's coming into the state. The corporations make estimated payments four times a year versus withholdings that we saw that the personal income tax has held. Majority of that is paid. So here is a 12-month period again. This is ending December 2004, and then you look at 12 months prior, all those estimated payments that are made by different industry sectors. And this red bars here show the counts. So this is basically Department of Revenue's data where they've taken the corporate tax returns and all coded them according to a particular industry group. So as you can see here, the number of returns that are unknown are the largest. Well, that's really meaning that there's a lot of returns out there that they just don't, they're not clear exactly what industry group they may fall into. And it may be because they don't have employees here in the state, in which case then they get a lot of this information from the Department of Employment database, and then that helps them in determining what sector they're in. So at any rate, just to kind of give you an overview here, what we've been seeing, which is what we kind of talked about the last time, the finance and insurance industry is the one that has the most in estimated payments by far here. You can see it's over $80 million in estimated payments for this 12-month period. And you can see wholesale trade then is second at about $50 million. And third here is retail trade, and then manufacturing is down here at about $30 million. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, it just helps you see how much, you know, manufacturing has really dropped as far as just the amount they are contributing to our corporate income tax. Now here, this is that same graph that I showed you before with withholdings, only now this is corp estimated payments. And this, again, is giving a reference period here of January 1999 as kind of basically forming an index from the amount of 12-month collections of estimated payments from January 1999 back 12 months. So from that point forward, what we're doing is looking and seeing how much the corporate estimated payments have changed. Again, the black line here shows all of the different sectors together. And you can see, according to the recession period here, which began, you know, probably about June here, you see that of 2001, that's really when you started seeing all sectors, corporate excise tax payments starting to fall, and they bottomed out here, you know, a little bit, you know, November of 2003, and then they kind of flattened there. But, you know, they've grown anyway, you know, slightly above where they were in January of 1999. And again, as we've talked about before, this green line here with the square boxes, that's manufacturing. Right? And there you can see that, you know, manufacturing was doing very well from January 1999 on up until about February of 2001, and then it started falling. I mean, it increased twofold from January of 1999. And then it started falling, and then you see until almost about March here of 2003, it finally bottomed out. And then now we've seen it, you know, go up a little bit, but we've also seen some recent refunds, you know, indicating that some corporations paid too much in estimated payments throughout the year and overestimated their tax liability. So we've seen a drop now again in November and December for a manufacturing sector. So basically manufacturing right now, as of December 2004, you know, given that 12-month period of estimated payments, they have not even risen to the level of January 1999. And so that just kind of gives you an understanding of where we're at. You can see they were above one here just even a couple months before that, say like in July of 2004, but that's because they were overstating their tax liability. And again, these are estimated payments. So corporations will many times want to make sure that they at least put in the amount that their tax liability would be for the year because they don't want to get hit with penalties. So that's the incentive then to make sure they pay at least the amount they're going to need.
Mr. Chair, question?
Yes. Representative Boquist is recognized.
Mr. Chair, maybe Paul remembers this, but I think I recall seeing on the economic forecast that we received eons ago, I'm not sure when, Mr. Chair, but it showed that information management or information category was still not necessarily in decline, but still low and not recovering. But I think I recall seeing that project management was like in this huge growth rate. That revenue here seems to be saying it's not making any money. Mm-hmm. Was I correct? I thought like the number one growing industry we thought in Oregon was project management. Yet this right here shows project management of companies being down in the low end. Is that correct? Didn't we assume the project management and the economic forecast was this huge growth area?
Paul?
Mr. Chair, Representative Boquist, you know, I think the numbers were small in terms of the total amount, as I recall, in terms of the overall size. So we may have had a high growth rate in terms of withholding payments, but that may not be showing up in the net income. Remember that these numbers in some of these categories on the corporate side can really be dominated by just a few companies.
Okay.
Because if one has a really good year, and you can think of some of the companies who they might be, that can really influence that industry. Mm-hmm. And what the percentage that are actually making net that account for most of these corporate income taxes is very small.
Right. A follow-up question, Mr. Chair?
Please. Yes.
Then I guess if project management is increasing, it may in fact be increasing. We may in fact be seeing revenues, but it might be, say, subchapter S or individual entities, whereas only corporate filers, non-chapter, subchapter S would be in this category. Is that correct?
Yeah, Representative Boquist, this is just C corporations, period. There are no S corporations in that. Okay, so just so everyone's clear, too, this management of companies, look at this, the number of companies. Representative Boquist, it's very, very, very small. Okay, so we're really talking about a few holding companies in the state. So, you know, when you look at these corporate tax returns, we're summing them up by industry, but these industries can be very small as far as the number of corporations.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
There was a tax that S corporations did pay to jump through the hoops back in 1986, and there was those taxes that were built-in gains taxes. Are the built-in gains collections from S corporations that were previously C corporations, are they included as corporate income tax?
Well, Chairman Butler, any dividends and stuff that are going to come to the shareholders of an S corporations are going to be in the personal income tax.
But there is a built-in gains tax that corporations are actually paying S corporations for those corporations who elected away from the C corporate status to the S corporate status, mm-hmm, with built-in gains in certain areas. Those are still collected as C corporation earnings, are they not? They're not paid by the individuals. They're paid by the corporations.
Chairman Butler, I don't know about those particular gains. I mean, I would think that any income that is reported, you know, any gains that are going to accrue to an S corporation, they're going to pass them through.
No, they're actually taxes that are paid by the corporations. I don't know that there are that many of them anymore because it was a special window of opportunity in the late 80s, but it still is available to you to do that. but the built-in gains tax is still a factor that you're going to have to pay the taxes at the corporate level. It's a corporate tax, but it's paid by the S corporation directly to the state and federal. There's a okay, we'll look it up.
Yeah, it's Chairman Butler. That just may be a federal tax they have to pay. Okay, so this is the various industries that had a decline beginning the 2003 legislative session. So this basically shows you all the different ones based just to help you realize and remember with the recession who was really hurt the most. Obviously, manufacturing was hurt the most with a reduction of 98%. And $114 million. And this is management of companies and enterprises also saw a reduction of $21 million. Information fell pretty significantly. Wholesale trade and finance and insurance all fell. So basically this just gives you your top 10 sectors and the changes that they had during that time period. Now, when you look at the lowest month in 2001 and that 12-month withholding versus October of 2004 and kind of looking and leading into now the 2005 legislative session, what we have seen is that manufacturing, you know, as of October of 2004 was still gaining $9 million. Well, if you were to look at that, these same statistics for December of 2004, this would be wiped out. Okay, so as we already saw from that graph, they've already gone below now a point in of their lowest point in 2001. The management of companies has, you know, seen some growth. Information has really seen $8 million in growth from their lowest point in 2001. Mm-hmm. Finance insurance, though, they're the ones who have grown the most from the recession at $9 million. Mm-hmm. Transportation and warehousing grew $2 million. So now I just kind of want to give you a little bit of a bigger picture on various different types of business tax returns. And these are the ones that are pretty easy for me to get data from. So that's basically why I'm highlighting these particular tax returns. So what you have are sole proprietors who pay the personal income tax. You have S corporations, which pay their income through the personal income tax system. The farms, again, pay through the personal income tax. And then the C corporations, which are going to be paying that corporate excise tax. So this is looking at the business income tax returns. And this is comparing the percent of the total business income tax returns in 1990 versus 2002. So as you can see here, sole proprietors went from 190,072 to 212,573. That's a growth of about 12% over that 12-year period. And that they comprised 67% of all the tax returns in 1990. You can see S corporations were a pretty small portion in 1990, but they've now grown to 45,723. This is by far the fastest growing business entity. Here is the S corporation. Farms, as far as the number of them, declined slightly, roughly 7%. Farms as a portion of the total in 1990 was 13%. And C corporations were roughly 13% of the total in 1990 at 35,000. And they have declined also, but not very much, just negative 1% over that 12-year period. So now when we look at 2002 business tax returns, we see that the sole proprietors have fallen slightly, but not that much, 67% to 64% of the total. But S corporations are the ones that have really grown, went from 7% of all returns to 13.7%. Farms fell slightly from 13% to 10.8%, and C corporations just fell slightly from 13% to 11%. So basically what this is telling you is that as far as the business income tax returns, S corporations were really the fastest growing corporate tax returns that were being filed of these of the C and S and farm and sole proprietors. When you look at it in terms of basically the percent of the total returns by income group between 1990 and 2002, but what this really kind of shows you is just the trends here with like sole proprietors in 1990, what you saw was a large portion of the total there had between 20,000 and 50,000. So you basically had, you know, about 70% of all the returns were less than 50,000. Now when you look at sole proprietors in 2002, you see that that has risen slightly. So you have basically probably about 90% of all the returns have less than 50,000. And this just kind of shows the growth over the 12-year period of the income that is earned by sole proprietors. Now, with S corporations, what you're seeing as far as the trends, the lowest loss category is almost 40% in 1990. Well, it drops to probably about, you know, 35% by 2002. But you have growth here in the 0 to 20,000 category, and then a reduction here in the $20,000 to $50,000 category. With farms, the number of losses grew slightly between 1990 and 2002, but the number of farms that had 0 to 20,000 income grew significantly, and then the amount between 20,000 and 50,000 dropped slightly. And then in the C Corps in 1990, what you see here is a slight increase between 1990 and 2002 of the number of returns that had losses. So you see the loss category moved over 40% by 2002 for C corporations. And the amount that the percentage that were between 0 and 20,000 remained about the same. You saw a slight drop here in the $20,000 to $50,000 category. And then the 50 to 100 remained about the same, but you did have a jump here in the above 500,000 category. So what you see is with C corporations, more returns grew, moved into the higher income over 500,000 category. Now, when you look at this as far as by business income, basically with sole proprietors, you see that they comprised 40% of the business income in 1990 at $1.9 billion. But then they grew over 97% to $3.8 billion over that period of 12 years. And then with S corporations, they comprised only 15% of the total business income in 1990, and C corporations were at 44%. Now, what happened by 2002, 12 years later, what we see is sole proprietors dropped as far as their portion of the total business income. It went from 40% to 24%. And C corporations went from 44% up to 61%. So what that tells you is the C corporations had more of an increase in their income, and their income was growing faster than these other groups. Like sole proprietors had an increase in business income, but it wasn't growing as fast as the C corporate income, which went from $2 billion up to $4.59 billion. And farm income just got negatively larger here, from a negative $67 million to a negative $273 million. Now, to just kind of talk briefly about some of the steps that corporations go through and really coming at their net taxable income. And this will kind of give you an idea of what kind of things are included on a tax statement and things that you can look at from a policy standpoint. What you see here to begin with, at the federal level, corporations will file a consolidated tax return. So they'll file with all the different corporations that are related to their corporation, and they'll include all the sales then from all of their business operations. That is the gross receipt then that comes from the company. And then what they'll do is they'll minus off then any cost of the goods sold. So this is pretty much their inventory as well. And then we get at gross profit. So we look at the sales minus any cost of those goods, and then we end up with gross profit. And then what we do is we add in then other income components. And this could be dividends that the corporation received. It could be also interest earnings that they had, if they had property, any rental property. So there's a whole variety of different types of income that could come in, and then that becomes then their total income. And then we see what's minus off then are deductions. I know these are the federal deductions there. These are things like their payroll costs, any interest then, rent that they've paid out in depreciation on their property. That's when we start talking about the 179 expense and the bonus depreciation. All that kind of stuff comes in here. When we're connecting with federal law, dealing with depreciation, we're connecting here with these deductions. So then when we have those various deductions, then we end up with a net business income. And this is before the net operating loss deductions and any other special deductions at the federal level for dividends. So basically what we end up with is a federal taxable income before the net loss deduction is allowed. And what we see is Oregon has additions, just like on our personal income tax return. We saw that Oregon has enough income that it is taxing that the federal government is not. So then that becomes our corporate additions. Those are, again, the things that we talked about at the personal income tax level, things like the interest earned on all state and municipal bonds. That's one of the biggest additions. Then we've got subtractions, and basically with the subtractions, these are the things that the federal government does not, the things the federal government taxes, but Oregon does not, and this also includes the dividend deduction, which we are bringing forward from the federal return, but we're also making adjustments here in our subtraction. And then we've got the net operating loss and net capital loss deduction. And this, at the federal level here, what happens is they're allowed a 20-year carry forward for these net operating losses. And then they also have a carry back of 5 years in 2001 and 2002, and then it's now back to 2 years. So, but here in Oregon, what we allow is a net operating loss deduction that is just carried forward, and that's for 15 years. Now, basically what we do is then we arrive, after we have these various subtractions, at Oregon taxable income. Now, in 2002, Oregon taxable income was $3.8 billion. So this is basically when you move from federal tax subtraction in 2002 to Oregon taxable income, it's roughly a reduction there of about 26%. From that federal taxable income. Then what you have here is then you take the tax rate that we're going to apply here in Oregon, and that's 6.6%. We have a flat tax. It's not progressive at all. It's just 6.6% on the taxable income in Oregon. Then that gives you an Oregon tax before credit. Okay, so now just to kind of give you a little bit of an understanding of Oregon's corporate tax rates versus other states' tax rates, and this just really tries to give you, you know, a little bit of an understanding of what is 6.6% relative to other states. And, you know, several other states are multi-tiered in their corporate tax structure. So what these stars indicate are the multi-tiered states. So we have 10 states that have a multi-tiered tax structure, and what I've included here is their top tax rate in that. So basically, we have 48 states that have a corporate income tax in 2004. What we see are 10 states that have that multi-tiered state. So you basically have 38 states that are like Oregon that have a flat tax. And Oregon is down here. Basically, 6.6%, and this is a rank roughly of 30 from the top here, with Iowa being at a 12% rate. Iowa actually has a rate between 6% and 12%, with the highest being 12%. Now, to just kind of highlight some of the trends in the Oregon additions and subtractions, what we see is that this kind of shows you here the Oregon additional income here. In 2000, what you saw, there was, you know, a lot more interest there from the state and municipal bonds. And so that's why you see here the additions being so much larger at $900 million as far as additional income. As far as the tax amount, it was roughly $45 million as far as an additional tax amount we were adding from corporations. And then we saw a drop here in 2001 and 2002. And again, this is just due to the lowering of the interest rate since the additions really are, I mean, there are other things besides the state and other interest income, but they're pretty small. I mean, it's like income of related foreign sales corporations and domestic sales corporations, some insurance addition for some of their realized gains and losses. When we look at the deductions, and this is really, again, what we don't have, we connect with some of the federal deductions, but in terms of dividends, but what we have are kind of some adjustments that are made to that. So what we see here is the subtraction income is really reflecting the amount of dividends that are paid out to corporations. So once a corporation pays out a dividend, then they can claim it on their corporate tax return as a deduction for the amount that they paid out. So what we see is on the good years, when corporations are doing well, like they were in 2000, we see here then, a really high deduction amount, and that's $4.5 billion versus 2001, where it dropped significantly to almost $3 billion. And so the tax amount there, you can see, is roughly, it reduces our corporate taxes by a little less than $150 million on these years, like in 2001 and 2002. Now we're just going to talk briefly about some of the corporate tax credits that we see. So this is kind of moving now from the additions and deductions from the tax that we find before credits to now the tax credit. So basically with the total amount of corporate tax credits used, this just kind of gives you a little bit of an illustration of between 1998 and 2002. Oh, I'm sorry. This is really between 1990 and 2002. I should have change that graph, but you can just kind of see, I mean, it's kind of interesting that in 1990, the amount of corporate tax credit used was only $22 million versus 2002 is exactly the same, $22 million. So you can see over 12 period of time how much it is, even though they arrived at exactly the same amount, you know, it was very volatile during this 12-year period. So what constitutes this volatility? Well, it's really due to how much corporate tax credits the corporations can use. So as their tax liability goes up, then they are able to use more of their tax credits. So we see here that like in 1999 and 2000, these were very good tax years for corporations. So what you see is the amount of corporate tax credits used was quite high. So there you hit your height there in 1999 with $43 million used, and in 2000, $35 million. This was another good year, 1994, $41 million. But this just kind of shows you, this really does add to some of the volatility of the tax structure when you have these corporate tax credits, which we'll begin to discuss. You know, sometimes there's quite a bit of unused tax liability or tax credits that's not being used. So when we look at this graph here, this pie chart, this really just talks about the corporate tax credits that were used in 2002. And the total amount there was $22.5 million. And our largest one here was the pollution control at roughly 32% of the total. That was roughly $7.1 million in 2002. And basically with pollution control, this is our largest one, and it's pretty consistently the largest one for the state. It allows up to 50% of the cost of pollution control facilities investment. And so that's basically how it's based, is on the amount of the investments made on pollution control. These credit must be certified by DEQ. And then another large one here is the business energy credit. And this is another one for, it's at 35% of the cost of the certified cost of the project. And this is, again, a certified project from Department of Energy. This one can be this is one that's taken over 5 years. And what we see with the business energy is that it was roughly $3.8 million in 2002. So it's pretty significantly lower than even pollution control. Now, the research credit is sometimes you know, it's second largest, but in this particular year, it's third largest at 14%, and it was roughly $3.2 million. And research credit, this is one that we did expand last session, and we had it expanded as far as the base. We in 2002, which this reflects, we had some restrictions on what were eligible expenses for research. And so it was pretty much this high-tech industries, things like advanced computing, advanced materials, biotechnology, electronic device and things. But now we've expanded it to include any eligible expenses at the federal level. So it's made it so that it's more basically the language at the federal level says that the research must be technological in nature. It has to be useful in the developing of a new or improved business component. So we basically just tied to the federal law, made it a bit simpler for corporations to be able to claim this. Again, this is 5% of the amount of research above a base amount of that research expenses. And we also increased the amount that could be claimed per corporation last session in House Bill 3183. So now, in 2002, it was roughly $500,000 as far as the maximum credit amount that you could have per corporation. Per corporation, now it's going to be up to $750,000 per corporation in 2006.
Madam Chair, or Mr. Chair, whoever has the gavel. Madam Chair, questions?
Representative Bocas.
Could you clarify this 22.5 million for 2002? I'm looking at the handout also that you gave us. Is it correct that these tax credits are of 35,000 C corporations have filed? There's only 655 that use tax credits. Is that correct? I think I'm looking at the base 3.5 in the green book.
Okay.
Page 3.8, I guess.
Representative Boquist, that sounds right.
That's
yeah.
Right. Okay.
And it's all the same data. You're right. I mean, this green book does give you 2002 tax year data for corporations, and it is basically the same data I'm using here. So, like, say, pollution control, I think there were 107 that actually claimed, you know, the credit. Only 77 taxpayers actually had a reduction in their tax revenue. So that's what you'll see with some of these larger ones. In business energy, it was 204 corporations that actually claimed the credit. There was 139 that actually had a tax reduction. So there is a distinction there. I don't know if it's probably 654 that actually claimed just some credit.
Okay.
Yeah.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you.
So other ones here, which you'll many times have bills on, are things like the farm worker housing, the low-income housing. These are both credits that are designed for the lending institutions. So with like low-income housing, it's a credit against corporate taxes for those lending institutions that make loans that are low-interest loans, that are below market interest rates for the construction or rehabilitation of low-income housing. So basically that's what this corporate tax credit is for. These are usually pretty small. In 2002, there's only 24 corporations that claim this low-income housing. Farm worker housing is, again, pretty small as far as the number of people who actually claim it. It's allowed for owners of farm worker housing that have been constructed. It's roughly 30 to 50% of the eligible construction costs. So farm worker housing is pretty small. Dependent care here is for employers who basically provide some dependent care assistance, either some information to their employees or some assistance as far as monetary-wise for their employees. And it's 50% of the total cost that the employer has paid for dependent care. Now, this just kind of shows some of the trends then in the C corporation's utilization of these major tax credits. So as we were talking about before, what you see here right away is pollution control can get quite large as far as the amount of credit that is actually used. You can see this was in 1999 where it was over $12 million alone, just the pollution control facilities credit. Research can get quite large too, but it's never been above $10 million. But it's fallen quite a bit here in 2001 and 2002. But that's, again, this is just the amount that's used of these major tax credits. You also see with low-income housing, it's pretty stable. It doesn't fluctuate a whole lot, but we have seen growth in this. And we probably will see growth more as there is more of a demand for low-income housing and these incentives get utilized. These energy conservation can many times be used by a wide number of businesses and even in a small capacity. So this is something that has potential to grow. And you can see in 2002, it's almost up to 4 million. And the dependent care has been dropping slightly, but it hasn't, you know, fluctuated a whole lot during that five-year period. So now this is the one that I really want to make sure everybody's clear exactly what we're looking at here. It is kind of important to take a look at, because we get a lot of questions on corporate credits, on expanding corporate credits and things, and we just really need to be sure you're clear on what we have in, currently in our system. And this is the total amount of unused credits, 2000, 2001, and 2002, and basically what you can see here, and I even went this particular one, I've got 1998 and 99 also, but what it shows you here is we've had up over 40 million in unused credits, okay, for, you know, 2001 and 2002. And what this should tell you is that, you know, for the person who has to forecast corporate, you know, revenues, this can be quite a big uncertainty when you've got 40 million of unused corporate credits out there, you know, every year to have to, you know, kind of incorporate that amount of unused credits can be part of the reason why it's quite easy to have a corporate kicker.
Representative Riley?
Could you explain a little bit what an unused credit is?
Representative Riley, these are non-refundable credits. So what that means is you can use a credit up to the point where you reduce your tax liability to zero. That's it. And then you if you haven't used all your credit up, then that's it.
Understood. Thank you.
Yeah, and then you can carry it forward. So what happens is that in most of these, like the research, I think it's 5 years you can carry it forward. Pollution control, I think it's 3 years. So, you know, the important point is how do we know what these unused credits is? Well, it probably doesn't correspond to just 1 year. Okay, it's probably several years of unused credits that they've carried forward. So most of these credits are allowed to be carried forward. Now, when you look at this in terms of actual breakdown of some of these unused credits, this shows you right away that our R&D credit is by far the largest in recent years as far as the amount of unused credits. Okay, so even though we saw that the research credit in 2001 and 2002 was, you know, a little less than 4 million as far as utilized, you can see they have over 20 million in unused. Okay, so this is obviously half of the 40 million in unused credits. So the research and again, this is tax year 2002. You know, last session we just expanded the research and development credit to make it more applicable to more corporations. And so this is something that this amount of unused tax credit for research is bound to grow. There's no question, because we were increasing the total amount per corporation as well as the eligible expenses, the base on which those tax credits are used.
Just Representative Esquivel, you had a question.
When you say that you expanded the research credits, does that mean that you encompassed more different types of businesses to be included in this, or the amount?
Representative Esquivel, both. Okay, we expanded the base, so there's no longer a restriction in law. There's just the federal law that we're connecting to. And that, as I was saying, if you can just show your research as technological in nature, that you're promoting the addition of a new component or something in your business, then you can use that as research, where before it was restricted to kind of high-tech areas, advanced computing. But then also another portion of the bill was to increase the maximum amount allowed per corporation.
From what to what?
$500,000 was what it was in like 2002 to $750,000. That's what it is. That's what it will be in 2006.
Representative Riley.
Are we connected to the federal code as far as the length of time that you can carry forward credit?
Representative Riley, no, we set our own carry forward provisions in law.
Thank you.
So yeah, they we are even like I was talking about those net operating loss, those we have different carry forward provisions than the federal.
Okay,
law.
Thank you.
And I don't know if I really touched on that well, but you know, we are connected with the federal tax definition of taxable income for corporations, just like we are connected with the federal definition of taxable income for personal income tax. So it's the same concept. We're both of them are connected. And so that's why we each session will be having these bills dealing with the reconnect. And that's what the big one will be this session. We'll be talking about that corporate bill that passed in late 2004, which had various provisions dealing with corporations. So that's what we will all be discussing. So I think the other one that has oftentimes quite a bit of unused tax credit is the pollution control facility credit. But this doesn't allow as long a carry forward. It's only a 3-year carry forward. So that is one of the reasons why you could see a bit of a smaller amount of unused tax credit. The energy conservation credit also here has to be taken over 5 years. So this is something that can be built up as far as the amount of unused tax credit. Okay, now we're going to just basically talk just a little bit about some of the multi-state corporations and kind of describe a little bit about some of those features. So what we have here in Oregon since 1984 is we have a unitary, we have adopted the unitary group recognition, which basically means we are taking into consideration one business as a whole. So the unitary group is just a corporation or a group of corporations that are engaged in business activities that constitute a single trade or business. So basically we're looking at the business as a whole. And we're kind of ignoring the separate legal existence of all these various entities and focusing then on the business practice. And so what we're having is these related corporations at the federal level will be filing combined federal tax returns. And if those activities are considered to be a part of an intricate group of corporations. So that's basically the unitary reporting requirement here in Oregon. And many states have this. We really can kind of minimize some of the intercompany transactions that is seeking to shift income or expenses between high and low tax states, and that's something that can become a problem if you have separate reporting requirements. And we also, one other point is just to recognize what gets put on the federal tax return as far as income is just income earned here in the United States. Okay, now we will include due to the fact of the changes recently in 2004, we will be now including extraterritorial income, which is just the income from foreign sales overseas. But, so those will be reported if they're considered to be part of a foreign sales corporation or extraterritorial income. But basically, we have a water's edge state, which means we do not have worldwide reporting. We just are reporting the sales and things that are here in the United States. So now what happens is that we have a multi-state income that is apportioned to Oregon. So we are apportioning just our business income here in Oregon. And again, this is the C corporations that I'm describing. Now, basically with the S corporation, all their income is going to be passed through to the personal income tax, and they will be paying taxes then, the 5, 7, and 9, on that dividend income that's passed through to the S corporation. Now, the corporate entity, it will pay this minimum corporate tax of $10. pay. So that is the liability that an S corporation has, is to pay a minimum tax of $10. Now, many of you may think of other types of corporations like LLCs or partnerships. They do not have to pay a minimum tax of $10. Okay, that's not what's required. It's just S corporations that are currently required to pay that $10. This $10 has been in place since 1931. As most of you know who are around, this was a major component of Measure 30, was the increase to a graduated minimum corporate minimum tax. And so a lot of the proposals that we've seen for these corporate minimum taxes are based on gross sales. So if you're interested in any of that kind of stuff, we even have some of the gross sales information, you know, taking the corporate tax returns by gross sales is in here, too. We've got a table in there. And if you want to know estimates and stuff, I can provide you that kind of stuff. But basically, this is one of the things that we've been discussing a lot last session and during those interims. Now, this just kind of gives you a good illustration of just the number of C and S corporations by industry type. I think many times we don't have a good sense of where our corporations are and what industries they're in. Are they large? Are they small? Now, when we talk about S corporations, we're really talking about the small corporations. So, you know, C corporations are really talking, they have no restrictions on the number of shareholders and things. S corporations, the shareholders are now restricted to 100. So, and there's other restrictions for S corporations that, you know, keep it small. So only small corporations are really going to incorporate as an S corporation as opposed to a C. So when you look at this, this just kind of is interesting. When you look at the largest number of corporations, this is just, you know, sheer number of returns, almost 10,000 returns there in construction. And that's, you know, by far the largest. The next largest there is the professional sector. That's professional, like architects and other services, CPAs and things. But with construction, you can see that, boy, you've got almost 70% of those construction companies are smaller S corporations versus the larger C corporations. And you can see, like, in agriculture and forestry, that's about half. You know, half the agricultural firms are larger C corporations versus S corporations. And the professional industry, again, that's, you probably got about 70% there that is actually the smaller S corporations. And these could be law firms and things, too, versus a C corporation. You could have here, these are the accommodation and food services. So you might think food services as being just the Kroger's. But there's a lot of smaller S corporations there. And so that's what you can see there. Almost 80% of those total corporations in the accommodations and food service is the smaller S corporations. Now, this just basically illustrates the corporate tax and tax returns by different income ranges. Now, this is, again, just the larger C corporations here that we're looking at. Now, what you see here is most of the C corporations' tax returns are in a loss category here. They have less than zero as far as income amount. So there's 21,474 returns. So that 61% of all the returns are in the loss category. So what does that mean? That means they're paying the minimum tax. Okay, so that's what the minimum tax of $10 is what's paid there if you have no income. Then as you're moving down here, you can see that for corporations that have less than $100,000 in income here, you can see that that constitutes another 12,996 returns. Well, those two together constitute 98% of all of the corporate tax returns have less than $100,000 in income. Okay, well, then that means that these last 2% of returns are really the ones paying most of the tax. And that's what you see here. Between for the amount of tax that's paid between zero and $100,000 here, that's roughly 7.4% of the tax. And that's really the story. So then, you know, 2% of the returns are paying 93% of the tax here. And you can see here, this group here, with income above $25 million, they're paying 54% of the total tax here at over $120 million. So this is really, you know, illustrate to you how few returns are really paying our corporate tax. And as we kind of started this discussion, that's why you can see those graphs being quite volatile, because you really might only have a few tax returns in an industry sector that's actually paying tax.
Madam Chair.
Yes.
Elizabeth, as I look at the total, coming back to the very first slide, as I look at the total amount of net corporate excise tax and income tax payments that are being received, that's I don't know how many hundreds of millions that total is, but it's a goodly number, obviously. At what, $800 billion, I think, 800 plus in a biennium, as I recall. And this is a 12-month period here. But then when I look at the total credits over on page, the credits is on page 6. Eight. Yeah, I think it's 8. Anyway, the total credits that were extended, yes, you're right, page 8. The largest credit was R&D, mm-hmm. and then energy and pollution control. The total of those is a little over $35 million in total credits. Mm-hmm. We have any when I've got 3% of the corporations paying 90+% of the tax. Do you have any feeling as to how much of the $35 million worth of credits went to those very few corporations? I guess the thing that strikes me, and I didn't realize this before, is that there's only $35 million in total tax credits that are being used in relationship to the hundreds of millions of dollars that are being collected. That was an economic incentive to keep corporations here and hiring, as well as to bring corporations to the state of Oregon. But is there some indication as to those few that are paying the bulk of the tax, what portion of that $30+ million of the credits they're actually using? Do they use the most of it, or the...
Chairman Butler, yeah, I don't have that particular, you know, like of the top 10 or something that pay the most tax, how much of the credits are they using? I don't have that information, but I would imagine it is a large portion of it because they've got the tax liability.
But still in all, they do have the tax liability, mm-hmm. and of course the amounts that we're looking at of total taxes collected in all of them is net of the tax credits already reported. But I guess what I'm thinking is that even though they may have, let's say of the $35 million, they were using $30 million of those credits, that still is a lesser proportion of what they're actually kicking into the total, they're contributing to the total general fund revenue. I guess my perception of what you're telling me, and I'm probably jumping to this conclusion, but it seems like to me that we are offering credits to the right groups of folks to try and either bring small businesses to the state of Oregon, get them started up, or trying to incent businesses that aren't necessarily reporting huge amounts of profits to stay in Oregon, to either kick their doors open or to keep their doors open. No feeling for that one way or the other, Elizabeth?
Chairman Butler, I mean, I think you're right. I mean, the ones who are paying the tax are the ones who are going to be able to use a credit. So, you know, whether or not we're hitting all those big taxpayers or not, I'm not really sure. So,
okay.
I mean, I would think so, but...
Okay. I guess I was really surprised with the small amount of credits. All this time, mm-hmm. I have thought that the amounts of the credits that were being actually utilized was, and I guess when our corporate excise taxes being collected were a very small amount in the immediate prior biennium, maybe that's right. If we've got $35 million worth of credits offered, and you're collecting $100 million, and it wasn't that low, obviously, but if you're collecting $500 million, then $35 million on $500 million is a much greater percent than $35 million is to $1 billion worth of income that's collected. And I guess, again, my perception had always been, when we look at a two-inch book of tax expenditures, the credits that are being offered in all of these credits and deductions, they're being offered in all of these various areas to incent businesses and individuals to come to the voluntary assessment system. I had always perceived that maybe that was, you know, like 40% of the amount that was that we could have been collecting in relationship to these credits, mm-hmm. and it's not even 4%.
Mr. Chair, just on the numbers. Keep in mind that 2002 is a recession trough year, and we did collect $195 million in 2001-02 in net corporate income tax collections, net of credits. That was a 48% drop from the prior year. So that was when we had a sharp drop, that was going to increase some of those unused credits because of the fact that net income was quite low. So that might explain a portion of it. The other issue to keep in mind is on the tax expenditures. Elizabeth went through the deductions and the exclusions from federal law. Oftentimes, those are all added up with credits.
I see.
And they're all called credits many times, when really the credits are a subcomponent of that.
Thank you.
Yeah, the credits are assessed after that 6.6% tax. But some of the things that we see in that book are subtractions that go down as deductions, right?
Correct.
That we're not seeing reflected in these graphs.
Sorry. Representative Hess, that's correct. What I've really started with is, you know, kind of the taxable income, which is really all you're seeing reported here, too. Right? You don't see deductions and you don't see the federal deductions for corporations in here. You don't see the deduction, dividend deduction, and things like that. So, yeah, it's just a reporting issue. And even like this particular graph here, I'm showing you net tax. This is after credit. Okay, so you would add the $22 million to this. That would be the tax before credit. So it's really about, you know, $250 million as far as credit. I mean, as far as the amount of tax that was paid before credit. And credit's reduced it by $22 million. If there's no other questions on this, I'll kind of... This is really a graph that was really designed for Representative Galizio, because he asked a question at the end of the personal income tax presentation dealing with just the top filers and how much do they pay of the total tax. So this just kind of tries to break it up here for you. The top 10 corporate filers, they pay 22.5% of the total net tax. Then when you add the next 10 corporations into the mix, you add another $21 million, so that comes up to $72.8 million. That's 31% of the total corporate tax. Then you add the next 10, so now you're up to the top 30 corporations in the state. They add another $13.9 million, so now you're covering 37.7% of the total tax. Now you add another 10, and you're up to the top 40. Now you basically have about $97 million as far as the total tax amount, and that's 42% of the total tax. And then you add in the top another 10, and you're at the top 50, and they pay 46% of the tax, and they pay $105.9 million. So this should illustrate to you that you really have almost 50% of your tax paid by 50 corporations. All right, it's almost at that. And this is 2002. So, again, as Paul was just saying, this was a recession year. This really kind of highlights the dependency that we have on some large corporate taxpayers. Now, when you have better years, then you have more corporations paying, and it's less of a percent of the total tax. Now, this is something that gets quite a... just kind of tries to help you show some of the trends that we're seeing in the number of C and S corporations paying the minimum tax. And as we're just discussing, that is a large portion of the C corporations. So all S corporations pay that $10 minimum tax. So this red striped bar just shows the S corporations, and the blue is the C corporations. But this red line here with the triangles, that really shows you the trend there in the C corporations percent of all corporations as far as paying the minimum tax. So what you see here is that this has grown to roughly about 68% of all of the corporations or C corporations, the larger corporations, that are paying the minimum tax. So basically this is what was some of the reasons why we saw the graduated minimum tax in Measure 30. Now, this just basically shows you some of the trends in multi-state corporations versus Oregon-only corporations. And this just tries to break them down for 2002. And what you see here is the yellow polka-dotted type of graph here, bars. Those are the Oregon-only, and the blue shaded are the multi-state corporations. So for the loss category, what you see is roughly about 70% of all the returns are Oregon-only corporations. And then you see this grows a little bit more in the 1,000 to 50,000 category. You got about 72% of all of the returns are Oregon-only versus multi-state. But what you see is the exact opposite as the income grows. So if you have above basically about 5 million, you've got about 15% of those returns are Oregon only versus 85% being multi-state. And then this falls a little bit for those corporations above 5 and 10 million. But really, when you look overall, from a total perspective of all returns, what you see is almost 70% of all of our C Corp returns are Oregon only corporations. So when we have a lot of discussions about multi-state corporations, it's really not a whole lot of returns. Okay, it's only, you know, roughly about 30% of our returns are multi-state corporations. Now, when you take this same graph and then just look at it in terms of the breakdown of the C Corp net tax, okay, now to look at the net tax, well, it looks almost exactly like the returns except for the total here. What you see is the majority of the income here, since that majority of the higher income returns were multi-state corporations. What you see as far as the total tax paid, then Oregon-only corporations only paid about 20% of the total tax. Multi-state corporations paid about 80% of the total tax. So basically that's really the story behind this graph. I mean, you see that the really large above 10 million in income, those are going to be multi-state corporations. There's only about 10% of those that are Oregon-only corporations. And I also should kind of highlight for you the dependence that we have on basically federal law, which is affecting these multi-state corporations, and as well as international law. And those kind of international conditions are really going to affect the multi-state corporations, and we're heavily dependent on them for tax. Now, this here just kind of tries to take one step further as far as just taking just the multi-state corporations and looking at the top 10 largest industry sectors. So this is similar to what we saw before as far as I had the S corporations and C corporations all lumped together. This just takes the multi-state corporations and looks at them by industry sector. And what you see here is the striped purple bars here are the returns, and then the yellow line here is the tax. So basically, what you have here is on the tax amount, and finance insurance is paid the largest portion of any industry group of the total tax. And so that was roughly $44.6 million. And that was roughly 23% of all of the tax. And then we moved to wholesale trade, and this became roughly 20% of the tax here in wholesale trade. Retail trade also paid about 18% of the tax. So these top three paid over 50% of the tax, finance and insurance, hotel trade, and retail trade. Manufacturing came in third here at roughly 12% of the tax in 2002. Now, as far as, again, the number of returns, as we talked about before, you don't see all that many returns in manufacturing. Management of companies and enterprises is, like, really small there. But you see them mainly in the finance and insurance, our bigger multi-state corporations, with, you know, roughly about almost 1,600 finance and insurance multi-state corporations in Oregon. Wholesale trade is got about 1,800 returns in Oregon. And the rest are pretty small, you know, less than 1,000 as far as the larger multi-state corporations. Now to just talk, you know, a little bit about this, the corporate apportionment formula, and basically how do we arrive at our multi-state apportionment income. So basically, generally, just to make sure everybody's clear, again, even yesterday, Susan Browning with the Department of Revenue was talking about a nexus section and things that they have at the Department of Revenue. So it's really important to understand with multi-state corporations, nexus is very critical, and determining that nexus and whether or not a company has nexus here in Oregon is a really tricky thing. And it's something the Department of Revenue has to spend a lot of time examining and things. So one of the things that basically determines nexus is, first of all, if you own or lease property here in the state. So if you have an office, then you have nexus here in Oregon. If you have a warehouse, you have nexus in Oregon. If you have capital or property that's employed in the state, so, you know, if you have a plant or something that's working, then that's something that is going to establish nexus then for you. If you employ personnel in the state, that's going to establish nexus. And also, if you derive income from activities in the state, like rental property, then that establishes nexus. So we really could provide, some corporations could provide services to Oregon and still have nexus without having, say, an office here. So you could have, like, sales that were taken from, say, Washington State over the phone, but if you shipped off the goods from Washington State to residents here in Oregon, but then you serviced those, say they were computers that you actually bought, but if you then went in and serviced those computers, then that the service personnel coming to the state of Oregon would establish nexus there then for that company. So that's an important thing to recognize, is we do just have to look at how much presence there is here in Oregon. And there is a very, you know, walks a very thin line about whether a corporation has nexus or not. And recognize that what we're apportioning to Oregon is just business income. And business income is defined as just income arising from transactions and activities in the regular course of the taxpayer's trade or business. So basically, to kind of look at the multi-state corporate apportionment formula, the multi-state corporate apportionment formula is really an attempt to measure this level of activity by a multi-state corporation within Oregon. Now, most all states calculate their apportionment formula by taking a weighted average of three factors, and they are the sales factor, the payroll factor, and the property factor. So basically, that's pretty common in most states that we're looking at those three factors. And what we saw here is we've been seeing a change here in our corporate apportionment formula. Now, for years, we had an equally weighted three-factor formula, and it was really only in the 1980s that we started seeing then some changes in different states and stuff as far as placing more weight on the sales factor. And then it was in 91 when Oregon went to a double-weighted sales factor, which was sales being 50% and then payroll and property each being 25%. Now, what's happened recently is now we have been moving to, in 2001 we passed House Bill 2281, which had an increase to an 80% sales factor. This is oftentimes thought of as the super sales. So we started that in 2003, May 1st, 2003. So basically, this is our corporate apportionment formula now. It's 80% sales, 20% payroll, and 20% property. Now, we passed last session House Bill 3183. And as we were talking about the research and development change that were made, they were also in House Bill 3183. And this bill also then increased our corporate apportionment formula to be even more heavily weighted in sales. 90% sales and 10% payroll and property will occur beginning in July 1st, 2006. and then we'll go to 100% sales in July 1st of 2008. So basically with the multi-state income apportionment, just to give you a little bit of a understanding of where we are relative to other states, basically the states that have a corporate income tax, we see that 50% of them use an equally weighted formula. And I want to be clear that I'll give you in just a second a table of the different state apportionment formulas, but I have for certain states that have more than one corporate apportionment formula, then I put them in as having more than one. So I've counted some states more than once. So out of these 15 that use the equally weighted formula, you have three states that also split that corporate formula depending on a specific industry. So that is one of the trends that we've been seeing in recent years. It's not only moving to an increasing sales factor in various states, but also having multiple corporate apportionment formulas depending on the type of industry. And then what we see is we have 25 states that use a double-weighted sales in some capacity. Of those 25, four states have split a corporate formula, so they don't use double-weighted for all of their industries. Then what we have are like five who are like Oregon that uses hybrid between 50% and 90% sales. And then we have seven which use 100% sales, and again, about three of those states have a split apportionment formula, so they're using more than one formula. Now, this basically is showing you all the different states that with Oregon highlighted. And this just basically shows you some of the states then that have these split rates or split corporate apportionment formulas and what they're split according to. And oftentimes it's manufacturing. So and manufacturing will get their own maybe more heavily weighted sales factor. Here in Oregon, we basically have a slightly different corporate apportionment formula for telecommunication and utilities. So that's the main kind of breakoff that occurred in 2001. So they have a double-weighted sales if they so choose. In last session, in 2003, there also was a provision put in House Bill 3183 to allow certain forest products companies to have a double-weighted sales corporate apportionment formula and not have to go to the super sales and not have to go to the 100% sales. Okay, now this is just basically a brief description here of kind of an example of how business income is apportioned. And I just want to make sure it's clear with everyone again, the requirements that you need in state law to have a right to impose a tax on a corporation is that the corporation has sufficient nexus with the taxing state, and also the corporation is not protected under, there's a public law that allows activities in the state that serve no independent business function apart from their connection to the soliciting of orders. So basically, if you were a company that just had phone operators, say, in the state of Washington, and you were just calling Oregon residents in order to try to get sales, if all you were doing was shipping the product to Oregon, that would not establish nexus. It's just then if you also have people coming into Oregon to serve those Oregon residents because of those sales that you made, then that would establish the nexus then in Oregon. So just recognize there are some examples when you wouldn't have nexus with the state, even though you may have sales in that state. So,
yes. Question. So, Elizabeth, is it a potential that if a company was doing business in Oregon and in another of the, for instance, an equally weighted state, mm-hmm. is it a potential where Oregon weighed sales more heavily to encourage manufacturing and industry to bring their manufacturers here and their overall employee jobs here. Is the potential that the total between Oregon and other states could be over 100%?
Representative Butler, I haven't seen an example where it could be over 100%, but you can have a lowering of the tax if, like, see, in this example here, California has more sales than Oregon. And so, you know, the portion of the total there is, you know, Oregon's portion of the sales total is much smaller than California's. So when then Oregon goes to a heavier weighted sales, then that means that this is, you know, less in payroll and property. So then their portion, that's overall tax goes down.
So it's conceivable that the total amount that would be subject to state taxes of all the corporate income, of 100% of the corporate income, could be a less than 100%. Is it ever possible to have more than 100%? Well,
I'm not sure. Yes, it is. I mean, if states are to, they can embark on a policy in which they would maximize revenue. Let's say that you're a state that has a lot of property and payroll and little sales. You could emphasize those factors, and another state that had a lot of sales could emphasize that factor and lower the property and payroll. So, in fact, and I go back a little further because I'm older than Elizabeth, but back in the 50s, that was really one of the concerns that corporations had, was that they would be overtaxed through state corporate income taxes. There was a lot of pressure at that time to have federal legislation that would determine these factors. What came out of that was the multi-state tax compact grew out of that. You heard Director Harchenko talk about that a little bit. And they recommended this three-factor formula as a voluntary solution so that there would be... If the problem comes up if states enact different formulas. If they all had the same, then you couldn't have that happen. If they all, no matter what it was, they all had the same formula and treated it uniformly, you couldn't have it. But you can have either 100%, more than 100%, or less than 100% if you have different formulas used by different states.
Madam Chair, I would ask that when we get into the actual bills that will actually have some of these issues coming up, whether it be relative to international taxation of Oregon corporations or those kinds of things, we maybe ask someone from the Department of Revenue to actually give us not a real corporation, but to line out the scenarios of how what are the elements that makes that attracts businesses to Oregon and that will attract more payroll and more investment in property, so that what we can do is we can make certain that as a committee we'll know what kinds of things that we're doing when we're trying to develop policy to encourage good family wage jobs and good investment in property, plant, equipment in the state of Oregon. So I just asked the department together with the legislative revenue to assist us with that. Madam Chair, thank you.
I think it was noted by Mr. Warner.
Andre.
Thank you.
I'm sure industry will bring us some, Madam Chair, but I'm anxious that we also just have, you know, a good smattering from legislative revenue and perhaps from the Department of Revenue. So we'll gain a flavor of what we're really trying to do as we develop tax policy to enhance Oregon's economy.
Okay, Chairman Butler and committee members, I'll just give you this, you know, quick example just because at least shows you something that gives you an understanding of what these apportionment formulas do. So basically what you're doing is you're looking at Oregon's portion of the total corporation's business income in payroll and in property and sales. So basically in this particular example, you look at Oregon having $12 million in payroll expenses. And that is, you know, 12 divided by 40, which then equals the 30% of their total payroll tax for this corporation is in the state of Oregon. And 40% of the property income is in the state of Oregon and 20% of sales. Now, if you equally weight all three of those factors, then you can just do a straight average and you get Oregon basically having 30% of the business income of this corporation, California having 70%. And what you arrive at then is if you take the total net income of, if you just assume it's $5 million, you take for Oregon $5 million times 30%, or $1.5 million is appropriated, a portion then to Oregon. And California has 70% of that $5 million, or $3.5 million, a portion to Oregon. So that comes up with an Oregon tax then of $1.5 million times 6.6% tax to give you $99,000 as far as the tax bill for this particular corporation for the state of Oregon. Now, if you went to a double-weighted sales, which is what California currently has. Now, if this is what both Oregon and California had, then you can see that this has dropped from Oregon having 30% of the total to having 27.5% of the total, and California then was 70% of the total. They now have 72.5% of the total because they have more sales than Oregon does in this particular example. So what happens, again, you just take the 5 million times each one of those percentages and you arrive at an Oregon tax then of what you have 1.38 million versus the and basically what you do is you come up with $90,000 $750,000 versus the $99,000. So this is a reduction in tax in Oregon of roughly $9,000. And then if you went even further, where Oregon was a super weighted sales, which we currently are at 80% sales, 10% payroll, 10% property, and then you had California the same, being double weighted sales, what you end up with is Oregon having 23% of the total income and California having, again, 72.5% of the total income. That then coming up with less than 100%, 95.5%. So you would really have to see California start to move to have a more heavier weighted sales here to compensate for Oregon having a heavier weighted sales in order for this to have 100% again. So then basically our tax here in Oregon has dropped to $75,900 versus when we saw equally weighted sales, it was $99,000. So this, you know, apportionment does have an impact. It does have an impact. And the reasons are is, you know, states like Oregon, which do have a lot of manufacturing and they want to encourage that, then that's why they've moved to the heavier weighted sales. Now, just to one last point, I guess we just have a few more minutes, is the sales throwback rule. And I just want to make sure everybody's clear what we have here in Oregon. But what we have is a throwback rule which applies when the state of the purchaser has no right to tax the seller or does not tax. So basically what we're saying is if a state like Washington, which doesn't tax, have a corporate excise tax, if they're not taxing, then what can happen is the sales can get thrown back to the state in which the sales originated. So usually the state that is actually receiving the goods is the state that would get the sales allocated in their corporate apportionment formula. But if that state does not have or not imposing a tax, then those sales could get thrown back to the state of origin. But what you have to see is that corporation has to have nexus then with that state. So basically this is an example where we took the same corporation that was doing business in Oregon, Washington, but now we're saying that they have expanded to Washington State. And what has happened is they do have payroll of $2 million, which establishes nexus then in the state of Washington, that they have $15 million in sales to Washington residents. Well, those are not being taxed because there's not a corporate excise tax there. And so basically what we see is that those are then thrown back to the state of Oregon. So if we say that this is an Oregon corporation that shipped off the goods to the state, the Washington residents, then since the sales originated in the state of Oregon, the product came from Oregon, then the sales can get thrown back to Oregon. So this is something that then increases our amount of sales here in Oregon. So the average before throwback would have been 28% for Oregon, 66% for California. And then with the average with throwback is basically 33% in Oregon and 66% still in California. So it does have a tax impact for Oregon, is having those additional sales being thrown back. And basically this example, this was originally the tax with throwback is $152,460. This is an increase of roughly about $23,000 in this particular example. But this shows you here the throwback sales by industry sector in 2002. So here in the state of Oregon, we had roughly $2.85 billion in throwback sales in 2002. And this is something that is self-reported on our corporate excise tax statement. So the Department of Revenue really doesn't have a way to kind of verify whether or not we're missing some throwback sales. Just corporations have to check a box that says, yes, this is throwback sales from another state. And then the tax amount that basically we saw in 2003 was $27.5 million. And by different industry groups, you see that it was mainly manufacturing that had these throwback sales, as well as wholesale trade. And those two together made up over 50% of that. So if there's not any further questions, that's really it for court.
Questions? Anything further, Mr. Warner?
No, Madam Chair, we have bills scheduled for tomorrow. They are under planning calendar there. We'll have I'm sorry, that's for Thursday. Tomorrow we have an overview of the economy with state economist will be here, Tom Pitowski, to walk through that with you. And then on Thursday you have some bills scheduled there on your planning calendar for public hearing, possible work session. We also have a series of bills for possible introduction on Thursday.
Thank you. We will adjourn.